Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msoucy, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, or X, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available on iTunes and, like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, friends, today is a very special episode because you're going to learn some lessons. But Ray Steele, the voice of Morning Edition here at WFYI, not only is he my guest this week, but Friday, September 1st, when the show drops, it's his birthday. So happy birthday to Mr. Radio Announcer, where we will be talking about movies, and yes, we will be talking about old school wrestling a little later on. And I think I might try to plan a collaboration between Ray Steele and Joe Shearer. That would be wonderfully frightening. So, and of course, we'll grab a pencil and find out what you've been watching this week and go around. But I do have a few short film reviews to share with you. Before we get going, new opening in theaters this week, and one of the smaller pictures, I'm hoping to see Equalizer 3 a little later on. I had a choice to see Equalizer 3 or go see Low Straitjackets in concert after rehearsal. I saw Low Straitjackets, so fun group. There's a drama starring and produced by, co-produced by Academy Award winner Hilary Swank called The Good Mother. Not to be confused with the Good Mother film from Diane Keaton and Liam Neeson that was directed by Leonard Nimoy in the 80s. Apparently, that's the time span where you can, you know, use the title again. Swank plays a widow who is down on her luck. She's not quite a raging alcoholic, but was a writer for a newspaper and has now been relegated to just editing stuff. She has lost her fire when it comes to writing, but things go from bad to worse when her son has died of a drug overdose, and also finds out that the girl that he has been hanging out with, she is pregnant. So they start a bond together. She has one living son who is a police officer who's trying to help out his mother, and we get her at a counseling meetings for grieving widows, grieving spouses. And as the film goes on, as I wrote in my notes, is this a coping drama or is it a revenge drama? And without giving away a whole lot, there's a little bit of both in here that's more cerebral than physical. So I have to give the film credit for that. Swank is always very good and very interesting to watch. She is surrounded by some familiar actors like Olivia Cooke, Jack Raynor, Hopper Penn, also very good in this. So you think it's going to go down one particular path, and it doesn't in a subtle way. So I was happy to see that that kind of thing. And this, I think that's also the reason why it's only getting a limited release. It is not a Liam Neeson revenge drama. So, but like I said, somewhere in between without giving away a whole lot. But anchored by a good performance from Hilary Swank. So The Good Mother opening this week. Catching up on the pile of movies that have been sent to me. From Kino Lorber, a film from France called Madeleine Collins, not Madeleine Kahn, starring Virginie Efira. She, another one, it's the crust of the film is the performance by this woman. She plays a woman with two lives and two families. She has a life in Switzerland with not being married to Abdul and her little girl, who is she's a little tough on the daughter. Meanwhile, she's also living in France with Maville and two older boys. And it's interesting to see at the beginning of the film, we see her collapsing outside a changing room and in an outside store, which I won't give away a whole lot. But to see a person with two lives, and what happens when they start to unravel, and what happens, and of course, the thing that you expect to happen in a plot like this, somebody from one world shows up in another, and that starts to unravel things. So, again, anchored by a good performance by Virginie Efira. E-F-I-R-A. You know, reading's a skill, friends. I was at a coffee shop this morning, and there is a thing called Cimarron tequila. I hadn't had my coffee yet. When I first read it, I thought it said cinnamon tequila. And that's more of that's a better band name, I think, than it is if they made a drink out of that. So anyway, Madeleine Collins is out on Kino Lorber from France. Also from Kino Lorber, from 1963, another René Clément film called The Day and the Hour. This is the third René Clément film I've watched in the last few weeks. Simone Signoret plays a woman who gets involved with the French resistance. She helps hide an American pilot, played by Stuart Whitman. This came out in 1963, and as she's hiding the American, feelings start to develop between the two, and then it becomes, is he doing this because he loves her, or is he doing this so he can stay hidden and get what he wants along the way? It's interesting watching this after the film Joy House, which was the one with Jane Fonda and Alain Delon, because you have the hiding elements of that film mixed in with the war and the French resistance portions of the epic Is Paris Burning, which I talked about recently. But it does show what the French were going through as far as making sure you have your papers, overcrowded buses, overcrowded trains, overcrowded towns. You know, one false move and you get detained no matter what. Obviously, the thing is, can they trust each other along the way? And I think if this were an American film, the melodrama and the heavy-handed score would play a bigger part. Fortunately, it does not, because it's René Clément. And it's a fun moment with Stuart Whitman getting a quiz from one of the heads of the resistance out in the camp. Anyway, I don't think it's as good as Is Paris Burning. I'd probably say it's right below it as far as war dramas. But the chemistry between Signoret and Whitman are pretty good. So, and this is, again, my third René Clément film in about a month. So The Day and the Hour is out from Kino Lorber from 1963. Speaking of can they trust each other, from Wellgo USA, there is a film called Kill Shot, not to be confused with the Elmore Leonard novel that was made into a film back in the early aughts. But we have, we have Jackson, who is as I found out in his IMDb, is an actor and a director and a producer and also a model, and it shows. He is a hunter living in Montana. He's currently working as a hunter guide for those who want to go hunt out into the Montana lands. We also find out he's a former Navy SEAL, also suffering from PTSD, also with major flashbacks involving his family. And he becomes under the services of a beautiful woman named Kate, who her initial thing was wanting to go hunting, but really wanting to spread her dad's ashes over nature. And this is one of those, it's shot in Montana, and I know it's shot on location, but there's also a few moments where it just looks like everything is green screen, including the horses. And as they are going on their trip, they have an encounter with some bad guys who are, there's a case of money involved, there's a hanging body, and what happens is, do we take the case and move on, or do we run away? There is a moment where 40 minutes in, we find the hanging body and the briefcase of cash. 7 minutes later, they are camped out, Jackson and Kate, and you know things astray when Kate comes out of her tent in a red and black checkered flannel shirt, knotted at the waist, and black panties. And trying to entice Jackson, but he will have none of that. And then the bad guys show up. And then becomes the part of, is she not going to wear pants for the rest of the film? She does. Sorry to disappoint some of you. But just the really heavy-handed attempt to seduce Jackson before the bad guy, and then the bad guys show up to interrupt the plans. But the more somebody asks, can you trust me, the more red flags this film has as a member of the audience. We get some fights that are done at three-quarter speed. We do get some stalking and fighting and a twist ending, as well as a tag on at the end that the film doesn't deserve. That I don't think it earned the right to do that. There's a final cookie at the end of the closing credits too, and like it's the Avengers, like, oh, we're going to have another one of these films. This has all the makings of a direct-to-DVD, direct-to-video, or direct-to-streaming, I guess. This thing would have been a huge rental in the 90s. Good-looking people, shoot, gun fare, a little skin, and a little fighting. And yes, there is a female bad guy, bad person, bad girl for the good girl to fight as well. So at least they're equal in their battle scenes. But a lot of pizza, even more beer. But yeah, Wellgo USA's release of Killshot now out on DVD and Blu-ray. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Just a reminder, my guys, Golden Globus Theater, it was they talked a little bit about their experience on the show last week, so thank you to those guys. This week, they're doing the Not Predator, Not RoboCop, knockoff, RoboWar, starring Golden Globus Theater favorite Reb Brown. So there will be a lot of yelling. It's good to have the guys on. And go check out Golden Globus Theater, wherever you get your podcast, and check out RoboWar. All right. We will go around the horn, and we'll grab a pencil in a little bit. But first, my chat with WFYI Morning Edition host and all-around good egg, Ray Steele. Happy birthday, Ray. Enjoy. Joining me on Film Sociology is the host of Morning Edition here at WFYI. He's new, and what's great is in the radio format, new means at least 2 years.
Yeah.
When it comes to formats and changes.
Particularly at WFYI, or so I hear.
You still have the warranty tag on you.
That's a joke. Come on.
I know. But he keeps you company in the morning. He gives you pop culture information, music beds that you don't expect. And when it comes to smoothness, if Gordon Solie and Lance Russell had a child, Ray Steele. Hey, bud.
Do they know who Gordon Solie and Lance? I would be chided if I said Gordon Solie and Lance Russell, probably on Morning Edition.
But this is Film Sociology, so
people
all
know.
Bets are off. Well, they
know,
will.
If you know, you know.
And
or you will.
We'll get to that portion of your life in a little bit, and then a big shout out to Joe Shearer, who's also a fellow IFJA member and wrestling fan. So we'll
Excellent.
Get to that in a little bit.
Aye.
So. How you doing, man?
I'm good.
How's your sleep clock? You did mornings at the other gig,
I was at Channel 6 before here and been at lots of places, and most of those places for the last 25 years now I've done mornings.
So, yeah, you're set.
Even if I don't want to be. For example,
what's
today,
sleeping in for you? If you're a bum, what is sleeping in for you?
6 o'clock, maybe?
Oh,
6 a.m.?
You slacker.
Yeah. But, the quality of sleep depends on the behavior of the cats overnight.
And your cats' names are?
We have Noble, who is a big, beefy boy with a very high-pitched meow. Kind of like, remember the big, what was the big, large cat in the Warner Brothers Looney Tunes cartoon long time ago? Who was the big softy? I'm going to love him, I'm going to squeeze him, I'm going to call
was
him
that,
George.
Was like a woolly, I don't know if it was a cat, but it was the of Mice and Men portion of Warner Brothers cartoons.
They did have an abominable snowman type character.
Kind of, yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah.
But,
Lenny.
Yeah, but they had a couple of cats, and the small cat was the tough guy, and the big cat was the doofus.
True.
Anyway, that's Noble. He's the big doofus with a very high-pitched
meow. I like big
meow.
Cat. You had Ernie Ladd waking you up.
Yes.
Wake up, Mr. Human.
And that wouldn't be the first time. And then we have a smaller cat named Maple, whom we adopted a few years ago from the shelter in Wayne County, where the wife was working at the time.
We'll get to that in a second.
Yeah. So, yes, two of them. Maple is deaf, we believe, too.
Oh, no.
So that's
cat language? That's, cat sign?
Oh, no, she still screams. She's louder now.
Oh,
maybe
so
it's because she can't
hear.
The
one who doesn't wear their hearing aid
yes.
just yells at you.
She's louder now than when we adopted her.
Wow. We have Anya. And we have Dimitri mm-hmm. because our kid liked Anastasia.
Okay.
And they wanted to have more. So
she's
they
not
could
a
name...
Soviet sympathizer. She is.
God, no. But she also wanted cats named Rasputin and Bartok. And like it doesn't sound like Hank Azaria.
Boris.
Sorry, and yeah, exactly.
Ivan and Nikita. Yeah.
Crusher Khrushchev.
Yes.
Oh, we're going there, folks. So, yes, your lovely wife, Jen. So, for those who don't know, Jen and I were part of a radio DJ exchange program between
yep.
Wayne County and Marion County.
Yep.
You had somebody living in Marion County who would drive to Richmond to do radio, and then you had somebody who lived in Richmond who would drive to Indianapolis to radio. I think it's a very underappreciated program, and hopefully it'll get some more financial support as time goes on.
She got tired of that drive and got out a couple of years ago. So.
11 years? 12
yeah.
years. I'm still, yeah. Car's in good shape. Disc player works.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all right.
All right.
So, all right. When it comes to, I was giving Ray some heads up on this because we are of a similar age. We are very much similar, Mr. Bond.
Yes.
There is that fine line between sharing a film with your family and inflicting a film on your family. Can you give us an example of both that you have done, Ray Steele?
Ooh. inflicting a film, well, anything that's about wrestling, certainly.
Really? You've shown them, like, I Like to Hurt People or the Vern Gagne film, The Wrestler?
No, I have not shown them. I've watched those. They've seen them around, and then
you don't
want to
show them to anybody.
They'll just go in the other room, you know.
Yeah.
The Wrestler with Mickey Rourke.
I do love The Wrestler with Mickey Rourke.
Oh, it's a great film.
By the way, friends, that's the one seeing that at a screening. About 99% of the time, a film just doesn't end right. It's too long. It's too short. And without really giving away a whole lot, when he climbs the top rope, and every critic's brain is going, and now, and it did.
Yeah.
So amazing.
And it was perfectly done. A film that I shared with the family, and I guess my wife and I deserve dual credit for this.
Yes.
Is essentially forcing our kids to watch The Blues Brothers.
Now, how old are your kids now?
Well, the kids now are 20 and 15.
Okay. All right.
But this was not that long ago, so it's not like they were little, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
They were old enough to kind of understand as long as we explained some of the old pop culture
Who's
references.
That guy?
Yes. And, you know, why are they driving around this mall and stuff like But now, the Blues Brothers is the oldest kid's favorite movie of all time.
Yay!
Like, she wants to watch that when she wants to watch nothing else.
It's just on in the background.
And now she wants to inflict it on everyone, even though it came along 20-plus years before she did. She actually did. And so much so, she bought the extended version with all the deleted scenes on Amazon. And now she watches that whenever she's at home.
She's not watched the sequel, right?
No.
That's, yeah.
Well, okay, I don't know that she has.
Don't need to.
No.
Please don't
no.
Yeah,
absolutely
sorry.
Not.
Yeah, I recently revisited. So my kid's 21, senior in college, and as I kind of like, they're like, even though Roger Ebert has been gone for many, many years, there is still an Ebert Fest in downstate Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my kid could curate the, my dad showed me this, but I don't remember film festival. Because a lot of stuff from like age 5 to about 8, they're like, yeah, Dad, yeah. I don't remember. But I was like, but I was there.
Right.
Yeah, but I don't know. So they sort of remembered the Blues Brothers. And then when they came home, because there was that thing where I wanted to share any film of note filmed in Chicago because we were fans of The Bear. And they had a friend who wore costumes on The Bear. Anyway, we revisited the Blues Brothers, and they're like, okay, I get it. I totally get it.
Mm-hmm.
So they were able to appreciate that. And the fact that we told them nothing is ever going to be filmed like that in Chicago again. You know, the mayor just wrote a blank check to Universal and said, have
yes.
at it.
Yes.
And the other part was, and they sort of remember, was you can see the mall chase on YouTube in Lego form.
Oh, that's right. I've seen that.
So there's that,
that's
the
brilliant.
Usual Suspects opening scene,
mm-hmm.
a bunch of Eddie Izzard pieces. So that was kind of a decent little gateway.
Yep.
So cool. I'm glad that they love that.
Now, when they were little, I used to show them, because I love old musicals, like old musicals.
And you know what? That the Blues Brothers, musical format.
Right.
Fits the musical format,
too.
It's like, but it's like a Mickey and Judy, except it's Jake and Elwood?
Yeah. Exactly. But I would show them the Gene Kelly movies and the Fred Astaire movies.
Yeah.
And one night, I mean, gosh, the oldest kid was three, maybe? Mm-hmm. And we just happened to be watching. We were staying at a hotel somewhere. I think we were visiting the in-laws over when they lived in Terre Haute. And this was long before we moved to Indiana. And we were watching Singing in the Rain came
yes.
on TCM.
Yep.
And the kid was mesmerized by Singing in the Rain and became one of her favorites. And then anything with Gene Kelly, you know, An American in Paris. And any time of Gene
Kelly.
On
the Town?
On the Town. Oh,
yeah.
I mean, the roller skate scene on the Town.
Yep.
As good as it gets. But also a huge fan of, because I love the Nicholas Brothers, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And particularly.
Look up the Nicholas Brothers.
They're, yes.
Your thighs will quiver when
oh
you see some of the splits
God.
These guys do.
I mean, what Fred Astaire himself called the greatest tap dance scene ever caught on film from Stormy Weather with
yep.
Bojangles Robinson and all those, and Cab Calloway and the orchestra. But yeah, she anything to do with tap dancing and musicals, she had to watch when she was little. Don't know that she watches those so much anymore.
Kind of same here, yeah.
But it's there in the background still.
Cool. All right. What have you inflicted on him? I will share. I tried showing The Room
mm-hmm.
to my... So my wife got up after 30 minutes and left and said, what man wrote this crap, and stormed out. And then during the... If you know The Room, there are love scenes that just go on way too long. And
yeah.
the kid just kind of threw a blanket over their head and said, tell me when it's done.
Yeah.
So that's – and that – my kid says The Room and the Mystery Science Theater treatment of Manos, The Hands of Fate are the worst cinematic experiences they've
man.
Ever had.
So see,
have you been that cruel to your family? Hopefully not.
I can't remember if I tried to show them Manos or not, because Manos – just happened to be the first MST3K I ever saw.
Holy cow, what a start.
Because I had never, I was in Alabama at the time, and cable system didn't have Comedy Central.
They just got
reason.
Mystery Science Theater, by the way.
Yeah, and so, but a friend of mine had seen it, who lived somewhere else in Alabama, who did have it, so he put it on a VHS tape.
Which
and,
is and what let, we did.
And gave it to me. And I was like, this is the stupidest,
Manos?
Oh, hilarious thing I've ever seen. And I actually got to tell Joel Hodgson that many years
Yay.
Later that was the first MST3K that I ever saw was Manos.
How do you like that?
And that was such a sweet thing to do. But I don't know that I've shown the family Manos. Christmas Vacation.
Ooh.
And the older kid who likes the Blues Brothers was the only one who liked Christmas Vacation. The rest of the family.
Yeah.
No.
I kind of knew then. Well, I think we sort of knew that Chevy Chase was kind of a bag, and
yeah.
and even the dad and Chris, I mean, the rant he has in the first Vacation film
mm-hmm.
where everybody's going to be smiling, they're going to be whistling, so it's such and
yeah.
such, I'm not going to do that. And I was like, that comes a red flag, even at that young an age.
Yeah, yeah. So there was that. I'm sure the wrestling movies, I don't know if I ever forced them to. I started Crush Groove. One time.
Directed by Michael Schultz.
Because I found it on Amazon Prime Video, and you know that took me back
you're,
to the
You're
day.
Revisiting that for this month, aren't you?
I am, because Sheila E. is going to be here for Jazz Fest. Yeah, so,
we also got A's in name-dropping classes at our respective colleges. So the other one I like to bring up, as far as musicals,
yeah.
and I got to I've known Guy Davis for a long, long time, and got to interview him on a few occasions. Anyway, he was playing a concert in Yellow Springs, Ohio. He, of course, starred in Beat Street.
Yes.
The other film, that's the one that's not Breaking, that...
I have that saved in my YouTube
do
videos,
you really?
By the way. Yeah, my YouTube
so
TV
So this
thing,
is
yeah.
Ray Don Chong... And Guy Davis, and
yep.
she's
Mario Van Peebles.
Mario Van Peebles is in that.
Yep.
He is he's a rapper, and she is a classical artist.
Right.
And so I mean that's straight out of a 40s musical of, you know, he performs one way and she performs another way, and they're
yes.
going to collaborate together. Totally 40s MGM musical. More historical background than Breakin'. Sorry.
Yeah, but that was the story of Breakin', wasn't it? Kind of the story of Breakin'.
Sort of.
Ballet dancer with Shabadoo and
Boogaloo Shrimp.
And Boogaloo Shrimp. I mean,
that's true. And then she would become later possessed by a ninja. Oh, well, that's Ninja 3 the Domination. Sorry.
That's right. And Breakin had Ice-T, who was definitively less gangsta in Breakin than
much
he
less.
Was in real life
much
at
less.
The time.
As, yeah. as we heard on Fresh Air this week.
Yeah.
So, and then they made the sequel with the famous title. So,
yes, yes.
All right. Okay, that's pretty good. During the early stages of lockdown, we were trying to do like movie night as a family and that sort of thing. And it worked for a little bit of time. So I remember showing Bull Durham.
Yep.
That the kid had never seen and really liked it. And partly because I told him it's a screwball comedy. It just happens to be set in minor league baseball. And so they dug that. In fact, they wanted a time machine to go back to 1987 Kevin Costner. And I said, I understand. And then we watch Tin Cup.
Oh,
underappreciated Ron Shelton sports film.
What was the worst Southern accent? Was it Dan Aykroyd in Driving Miss Daisy or Kevin Costner in Tin Cup?
I didn't even notice it there because I was blinded by Don Johnson's golf shirts. No, that's – I think – and trust me, I think we'd rather have Costner as Shaggy Underdog as opposed to the Second Coming of Gary Cooper and stuff like JFK and the Bodyguard.
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
And those two went well. And then I went to the well one too many times, and I grabbed a film that it should be in the Dad Film Hall of Fame, The Untouchables.
Mm.
I loved it. My wife handled it. My kid's like, sorry. But I did get them to watch Fandango, and that's another chat for another time. I was very happy about that. So,
yeah. Okay.
So you grew up in Alabama.
Grew up in Georgia,
actually.
Georgia,
sorry.
No, it's okay. North Georgia. Was born in Chattanooga, but that was the big city. Trenton, Georgia was just across the state line, about 20 minutes from Chattanooga, but right in between the way the interstate runs. Between Chattanooga and Fort Payne, Alabama.
Okay.
So in between two mountains. In between Lookout Mountain and Sand Mountain.
All right.
So that was home. But I have spent time in Alabama for college, went to Jacksonville State, worked there, did the Southern radio tour is my joke. I was like moving every 2 years.
Chitlin' Circuit Radio.
Yeah, pretty much. I went to Huntsville, Birmingham, then went over to Charleston. Went over to Memphis, to Raleigh, to Savannah, and then finally here. And finally we stuck in Indy.
So what's great about Southern radio, friends, is that you can go on AM and you can be told by Caucasian radio people and African-American radio people that you're going to hell in a handbag.
Oh,
equally.
Yeah. Yes.
It's hard to find that balance.
That's the first station I worked at was in my hometown, Trenton. It was a little AM station. And we had it was a country music format, except of course for Saturdays and Sundays.
Oh,
it was Southern
yeah.
gospel, and the preachers, the aforementioned preachers, some of whom, and I promise I'm not making fun of people here. Some of them were legitimately illiterate though, and the Bible was legit the only book that they could even come close to reading.
Got it.
And they were the preachers who usually bought the time on Sunday afternoons.
Yep.
So
there, be okay.
And then I got the same thing. A friend of mine, when I was in college at Jacksonville, there was a little AM station, WPID, Piedmont, Alabama.
Okay, not PID.
No, not PID. Piedmont, Alabama, who we worked together at the college station, but he ran the board Sunday mornings for WPID, and he was blind also. So I used to drive him to work sometimes on Sunday mornings and
wow.
then hang out there just so I could see the menage of preachers, white churches, black churches, it was phenomenal.
Impeccably dressed for radio.
Oh, absolutely,
yeah.
Yes. And there was one church that always, they had a song that they wanted to play
on a
cassette, but they never would give the cassette to the board operator. They always would play it on a little, it wasn't even a boombox. It was a cassette player with one speaker, and they would hold one of the microphones up to it in the studio.
I've done that. So two stories involving WCRD, Ball State Radio,
mm-hmm.
because I was there for year two
yep.
of its existence. And at that time, it was only broadcast in the dorm. So I was entertaining dozens of people if I was lucky.
Yep.
And I started out doing news, and we had a DJ who was blind. And so we had kind of like this room, which doesn't help for radio. There is a window between one studio and another. So, you know, he and his buddy would be on the main board, and I would be in the other room doing the news. and it always worked. It never ceased to fail. I would be reading the news, and this guy would take his glass eye out. So it would be weather on the Ball State campus. Oh! Always because I was 19 and dumb. So there was that. And then my first big interview was with McIntyre Murphy.
Mm.
So he was with, this is 1991, 92, I believe. He was with Antone's Records down in Austin. He was going to play at the Slippery Noodle. This was my first time at the Noodle. And it was great because, you know, and we get this press kit and they're like, hey, do you want to give away some CDs? I went, yeah, because that's what the regular stations did. Yes, they sent me a box.
Oh, wow.
A box about as wide, about as long as the keyboard. So probably about 20 CDs of McIntyre Murphy's latest album. I was able to give away legitimately on the radio two.
Oh, man.
And then eventually it got to, you know, you try to do the contest and you're like, please call. don't say that on the radio. It's kind of like that, the one politician that, oh, Jeb Bush, don't say please clap.
Yes.
And eventually I was just going through my dorm going, hey, you like music? Here. So I interviewed Matt on a micro cassette.
Mm.
We had no way of converting it over. So like your preachers, I played a micro cassette over the microphone. That's high tech 90s radio.
Sure is.
In college, man.
Sure is.
What was your neighborhood movie theater?
Neighborhood movie theater. Well, we didn't have one
in
Trenton, so we always had to go to Chattanooga.
I wondered if it would, because if it was like the downtown that eventually diminished and there were suburbs or strip malls or what have you. Okay.
They never, to my knowledge, had an actual movie theater in Trenton, which is odd because now they have a drive-in in Wildwood, Georgia, just north of Trenton.
Okay.
Just before you get to, it's just kind of in the middle of nowhere. They built a drive-in theater out there. About within the past decade or so.
Really?
And apparently it's doing really well.
Cool.
But,
all right.
Yeah, nothing like that when I was a kid. We always had to go to Chattanooga, which I actually went to a drive-in when they still existed in Chattanooga. I don't know if they have any now, but we went to see. Okay.
All right.
We went to see a film that was partially shot in Trenton, Georgia.
No, really?
And you'll remember this, The Night the Lights Went Out in Georgia.
Oh, my God, yes. Jamie Lee Curtis.
With Mark Hamill. No,
Grandview, USA. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Sorry. Mark Hamill.
Mark Hamill and Christy McNichol.
That's right.
And Dennis Quaid.
Yes.
Before he was anybody.
There was a period, friends, where a song could get made into a film. Yes, we're looking at you, Convoy.
Yep.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
And it follows the song?
It did follow the song.
Vicki Lawrence not involved?
Nope. A lot of people that I know and who are still with us were extras in the movie. My grandparents, both of whom, my grandfather has passed away, but he and my grandmother were extras in a courtroom scene.
Oh, wow.
That they shot at the old courthouse, which still stands on the square in Trenton, Georgia. We all got autographs, lost those autographs a long time ago of Mark Hamill, Dennis Quaid, Don Stroud, who had
classic that guy.
Yes, he was in it. They were not letting anybody near Christy McNichol at the time. Because it's hard to remember just how huge Christy McNichol was back then as far as...
Hamill as well. This was this was one of his non-Star Wars pictures.
That's right.
It's right up there with Corvette Summer.
Yes.
And the Big Red One.
Uh-huh.
Nice.
And I think the thing that stunned me, and I guess I wasn't expecting it because I was still little, if you remember who remembers this movie except us dorks? But first scene in the movie... Dennis Quaid's naked butt.
Yep.
And I was like, okay, I wasn't expecting that at 9, 10
Didn't
years
expect
old.
To see that, yeah. So, of course, up here, he had done Breaking Away.
That's right,
1979.
Yes.
1979. So,
yeah.
Gosh, is that film even on video nowadays?
I have to look. No idea.
So, let's see. I was an extra in Die Hard 2.
Mm.
They shot the ending in at an Air Force base in Alpena, Michigan.
Okay.
So... There's a two nights, $70 a night, froze my noogies off. there's a scene where it's the final moment between Bruce Willis and Dennis Franz, and he tears up his parking ticket and all as well. And I am behind Bruce and Bonnie Bedelia wearing dark charcoal pants, black suspenders, gray striped shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was outside, we all got to go down the emergency chute. So you couldn't wear your shoes and you couldn't wear your coat. So I had ski pants, sweatpants, jeans, and then the gray pants over it. Four shirts. And I'm standing over the guy. So the power of the pause button. So I'm happy about that, that we were able to do that. And then auditioned for Blue Chips and did not make it. And that's really okay, which they shot at the Frankfort High School in Frankfort, Indiana.
That's right.
So you also had cable in the early incarnations?
Yes. The Trenton Cable Company came into existence, I think, when I was eight. Okay. No, the first time we got cable, I was six. And the only reason I remember that, it was summer of 78. I remember the first baseball game that I truly, honestly remember all of and can quote from you. And there's a reason why. Was Atlanta over Cincinnati, 16-4. And because, you know, Atlanta sucked back then.
Yes.
Really bad team. It was on TBS, obviously. But that was the night that Pete Rose's 44-game hit streak was snapped.
Gene Garber.
Gene Garber struck him out for the last out.
That's right.
And celebrated like he had won the World Series. And Pete Rose, being the jerk that he is, just really got hacked off about
yes,
that.
Yes, he did.
Larry McWilliams was the starting pitcher for Atlanta that night, too, I remember. Anyway.
Was that the same year that Ted Turner managed one game?
That was 76, before they banned him from the dugout, before baseball banned Ted Turner. I miss Ted Turner so much in baseball. Oh, gosh. In baseball, absolutely,
okay,
yes.
Okay, all right.
Overseeing Atlanta. Anyway, and of course, I was introduced to Georgia Championship Wrestling that summer.
We'll get to that.
On TBS.
We'll get to that.
But that was the first time I remember cable. And I remember that. And then I remember about just a few days after cable TV became a thing in Trenton, they had, of course, the public access channel.
Oh, yeah. That's a lost. Well, it's still kind of floating out there.
Right?
But especially in it was like the Wild West of you could let anybody on.
But I remember them bringing cameras into our school classrooms to shoot video. For some reason, this channel was still in black and white in 1978, 79. Okay, this public access channel. So here we are, my third grade class, Mr. Pierce's class at Trenton Elementary School, and we're in black and white on TV, but we're still on TV, so it's a big deal.
Yes.
But like a few days after we got cable, all of a sudden, cable was out. And there was, snow on every picture, blah, 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 and we didn't know what had happened. And so it comes back like a day or two later. And on the public access channel is an explanation of what happened. It's one of those old cards that they just would just print up and hold in front of the camera.
Yeah.
And all it says, "We apologize for the loss of your cable service this week. Someone shot the cable." Meaning that that's all the sign said. Somebody had gone to wherever their transmission center was and shot the actual cable line until it broke. And that's how everybody who had cable from Trenton Cable Company,
oh my God,
in its infancy, lost cable.
We had, growing up in Flint, Michigan, I'm fine, we had what was called Channel 100. This was this was before HBO. So there we had that. And of course, my dad, we were the first ones in the neighborhood to buy a VCR, the 800-pound top-loading Betamax. We didn't know then. It was 1978.
Yeah.
And the first video my father ever purchased was Harold and Maude.
Oh, wow. Okay.
My introduction to dark comedy, friends. That also explains a lot. But we had Channel 100, and then they would weirdly wedge in intermissions for some reason. So, because I remember in halfway through Smokey and the Bandit, where hold my hat, son, and the hat flies off. I wish your head was in it, which we can't. And then there was then you hear If You Were a Magnet and I Am Steel from Chicago.
Uh-huh.
Was it Chicago? No, some other group. Anyway, but it was also that period of, it's animated, just put it on during the day, which is a bad move for animated films in the 70s, friends.
Yeah.
We went through probably the most bizarre era for animated films because, yes, you saw The Mouse and His Child, which is a bit off-putting, and Raggedy Ann and Andy, also off-putting, but Fantastic Planet
and
Watership Down.
Uh-huh.
No, not for kids. I mean, they knew Ralph Bashkin. We knew Fritz the Cat because it had an X rating. They weren't going to show that, but everything else was kind of fair game. Like, what in the hell are you doing?
And there was heavy metal as
heavy
well.
Metal,
was that,
which
was that era, yeah.
I had the most popular VHS tape. We later converted because the Betamax lost war. But I had this borrowed by so many friends on 1 6-hour tape. 6 hours, I know. Clockwork Orange, Tommy, and Heavy Metal. And
wow.
Yeah, there were guys, we bought Name of Substance.
Uh-huh.
Could we borrow the tape?
Like, oh,
okay,
man.
Yeah, that's fine. So, yeah, those were the stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
Man. Now, I never saw Heavy Metal. I still haven't seen Heavy Metal.
Really?
But I remember the commercials for it.
Yeah.
That's why it sticks with me, I remember the commercials for it.
Is it streaming? You should check it out.
I'll find it, yeah.
I think that might be an inflict if you ask Jen to sit down and watch that. Yeah, it is, because Heavy Metal Magazine, Mrs. Soce likes to use the term made by boys for boys.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's definitely.
Yes. That's what I would get, you know, if, like, Revenge of the Nerds popped up on TV, you know.
Ooh, yeah.
You know, well, I'd be like, I'll just leave you alone with that. Yeah.
Hasn't aged well.
No, it hasn't.
No, it hasn't. Oh, the other one, because I remember there was a double feature of this because they were both put out by 20th Century Fox. I was able to share with the kid Bachelor Party.
Oh, man.
Only because of Tom Hanks. They even said to me, you know, it was like, if he wasn't in this, I would not watch this in a million years.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was like, yeah, he kind of elevated the film itself.
Oh, well, you think? I mean,
with
Tony Katane didn't? Come on. I mean.
Well, yeah, I had the show. I showed like the first 30 seconds of Here I Go Again. My kid went, she's known for Bachelor Party and this.
I'm and like, that.
Kind of afraid. So.
And, you know, that was
beating the crap out of David Justice.
That's true. Well, I thought it wasn't David Justice. It was, he pitched for the Angels.
And the Indians, I thought.
Oh, crap. Yeah. And I can't remember his name. Doggone it.
Oh, no, because the story with that is.
Chuck, what's his name? Oh, man. It was a good pitcher, too. I know. Here we are. Googling. Chuck Finley.
Chuck Finley. Sorry. Sorry, David Justice. Sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah, because
David Justice was with Halle Berry for a bit.
Way to go, David.
Yeah.
There was. No, because one of the baseball stadiums, their sound person got fired because they played in the heat. Yeah. Oh my God. So yeah. Anyway, now we're getting into half sentences here at Film Sociology.
Yeah.
Okay. So you grew up in Georgia. You grew up in Alabama. How huge was territorial wrestling back then?
Well, I mean, it by far was the highest rated program on TBS for a while.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to. It's hard to imagine, knowing what television ratings are, if you know anything about TV ratings, just how huge a market share that Georgia Championship Wrestling had on TBS in the 1970s and early 1980s, prior to what became known as Black Saturday, when Vince McMahon, which is a whole other story,
one of these things is not like the other,
bought Georgia Championship Wrestling. When Gordon Solie was the lead commentator, when it was controlled largely by a man named Jim Barnett, who controlled the Georgia territory for the National Wrestling Alliance, the NWA, things were mostly run by a combination of Ole Anderson, Dusty Rhodes, the Briscoes, and people like that.
There's a brunch there, right, by the way, friends?
Yes. It was the biggest thing on not just Atlanta. I mean, Atlanta TV, certainly, when TBS was just a local channel, Channel 17 in Atlanta, but when Ted Turner had this vision of making it the superstation and putting it on satellite and putting it on cable systems all across the country, it became one of the biggest things going.
So for me, growing up in Flint, the Detroit territory was kind of stagnant thanks to the Sheik, and Bobo Brazil was getting older and older. Now
they still had to win all the matches.
They still had to win all the matches. Yeah, so it was not the I've told the story. My father was a ringside physician for boxing, Golden Gloves in wrestling back in the '60s.
Yeah,
and so, but yeah, it was not the greatest territory in the world, and by the early '80s, I was spending summers with my grandmother in Trenton, New Jersey. So here's how a kid gets fat, staying with his grandmother, never leaving the house because it's too hot, or never leaving the house when it's dark because she can't drive. And you could watch baseball on certain, maybe like on a Saturday, you could watch baseball for 12 hours straight.
Oh, yeah.
Because Philly, you had the Phillies, the Mets, and the Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
You had TBS, WGN, and they still had baseball on the networks.
Mm.
So, but yeah, I remember seeing wrestling on TBS then, as well as the Spanish channel. So they would speak in entire Spanish until superstar Billy Graham shows up, the Karate Master, of course,
right?
Or as he was once referred to as the Florida heavyweight champion of the world.
Yeah.
Wait, what? So yeah, these things would invade TV stations, and that's where you would get either the studio audience of 20 people, you'd get some house film matches.
That was something. I mean, the very first wrestling I saw was also studio wrestling. It was in Chattanooga. Nick Gulas was the promoter in Chattanooga, but they shared a lot of the same talent with whoever was in the Georgia territory at the time, or who was with. Jerry Jarrett in Memphis, with Memphis Wrestling, Jeff Jarrett's dad. Of course, Jerry the King Lawler, the legit king of Memphis.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the Memphis people would be on Chattanooga Wrestling. The commentator was Harry Thornton, who was a longtime Chattanooga television personality. And that was the first place I saw Beautiful Bobby Eaton, long before he was Beautiful Bobby Eaton, was in Chattanooga. Tojo Yamamoto, who was a guy from Hawaii, who, of course, pretended to be the evil, quote-unquote, Japanese guy with the wooden shoes.
And by the way, wrestling racism, really terrible. Terrible.
Talk about things that didn't age well.
Yes.
70s and 80s wrestling, if a black person or an Asian person were involved.
Yeah,
yes.
It's if you remember when they added more Super Friends just so there was inclusivity,
yes.
And you're like, oh god, that's really bad. That's kind of wrestling. So there was that aspect of it. Did you ever go to any of those tapings?
To the TV tapings? No, I wish I had. Man, that would have been fun to see the old TV tapings. I went to the matches a few times. It was much later. I didn't go to live wrestling until. Gosh, mid-80s, I guess.
Same here.
So, I mean, that was, you know, WCW days. And then WWF, when they came to Chattanooga much later, I think I saw them when I was like 17 or 18. So, yeah, about that time.
Okay. So, yeah, in Michigan, the WWF would go to Detroit by this time, something like 85, 86,
mm-hmm.
about once a month. Sometimes, one time they actually went to the IMA Sports Arena, which is where I had my high school commencement, where my brother played his league hockey. I saw George Thorogood in concert.
Yeah.
And the Bulldogs and Hart Foundation in the blue steel cage match, that blue fence thing. And then the NWA was coming up from time to time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I did go to WrestleMania III. Up at the Saginaw Civic Center, saw Garvin and Flair, Garvin and Flair, go for a one-hour draw, and then later saw Garvin beat Flair for the title Joe Louis Arena.
Yeah.
Slapped hands with Barry Windham. So that's my big claim. The other one was the first WWF match I saw in the Joe Louis Arena. Mm-hmm. It was, I think the headliner was Morocco and Steamboat, which led to a rematch of Steamboat and Hogan versus Morocco and Fuji.
Oh, okay.
So you got to see Fuji's diving head.
Yeah.
But I saw somebody throw a beer at Jim Neidhart, and Jim decked the guy, just knocked him out. So he's coming down the aisle, friends, and, you know, drunk buffoon throws a beer at, you know, a 280-pound guy.
Yep.
And that kind of, there's a code, and that code was if you get hit with something, you hit them back.
Yes.
So that's kind of what happened there.
The funniest incident that I saw at ringside, we saw WWF in Birmingham, Alabama. It was just a house show at the Boutwell Auditorium where they used to do Continental Championship Wrestling. This was where Gordon Solie went after Georgia Championship Wrestling in Birmingham. And a wrestler named Mark Canterbury was doing a character known as Henry O. Godwin, H-O-G at the time. He was a hog farmer, his character was. And he comes out.
Great representation of Hill Country.
And he brings a slop bucket to the ring with him, of course. Now, we got great tickets. We were like on the second row, corner ringside. of Boutwell Auditorium for this show. It was phenomenal seats. Sitting in front of us, however, were, again, not to shame anyone, but it was a man and woman who were not small. We'll just put it like that.
Yep.
Okay?
Yep.
And so they had been sitting there and had not said a word the entire evening, okay? Henry Godwin comes to the ring. He's walking in with his twangy theme music, and this big guy gets up in front of us and just starts screaming at Henry Godwin. I don't know what it was about Henry Godwin, but he was just going off.
We don't act like that, maybe?
No. And so Henry, just standing there looking at the guy, taking it all in, mm-hmm. taking his abuse, just letting him get it off his chest. And finally, the man stops. And then all Henry does is he looks down at the man's wife, we assume.
Oh, no.
Looks down at the man's wife and then looks back at the man and says, I see you brought your Sal with you. And he walks away.
Oh, man.
And we died. We're sitting right behind this couple, and we just lost it. We were in college at the time.
Wow.
So this was early. This was like 92, probably. So.
Yikes. And, yeah, so growing up, you had the WWF had at least two programs. Mm-hmm. WCW and NWA had programs.
Yep.
AWA was on ESPN, along with roller derby. Thank you for that.
Oh, absolutely.
The California T-Birds.
Yes.
And then, oh, God, one of the cable channels had WCCW, the Von Erichs, of
yeah,
course.
I used to watch that on cable.
So that was a great – when you didn't have a driver's license, cable was your friend.
Right.
I would just say that.
See, I had family in Louisiana, too, so we would go visit them. That was the first time I had never heard of, like, Mid-South Wrestling and
right.
World Class. Until I visited them, because it wasn't shown on cable in Trenton at the time. It was a short time after that, but yeah, I saw Mid-South for the first time when visiting family in Louisiana. The first time I saw a Junkyard Dog was there on TV. And
thin, muscular Junkyard Dog.
Much thinner, much, and you know, and he used to talk more normally in Mid-South
yeah.
wrestling.
Than, yeah, that's true.
Than when he worked for Vince McMahon.
You had to hype up the thing there.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
But JYD, Ted DiBiase, saw Mr. Wrestling 2 as a bad guy for the first time.
That's right.
In Mid-South.
He slapped Magnum T.A.
Yes. Yeah. His then mentee at the time. man, that was good stuff.
The thing that cracks me up about Mr. Wrestling, too. Well, there were things. If you were a masked wrestler,
mm-hmm.
which meant you were probably not the best-looking guy or not the youngest-looking guy.
Right.
But slap a mask on and you got at least 5 to 10 years of extra career. Kind of like in the early stages of MTV where they wanted – they needed videos from anybody.
Yes.
So, you know – three bearded guys, well, two bearded guys and a guy with a small mustache from Texas,
mm-hmm.
just put cars and babes in your videos,
yep.
and you're going to be on, if you're a German rock band, Scorpions.
Yes.
Put babes in your videos, Fabulous Thunderbirds, same way. Like,
yep.
these are not the most. Kim Wilson used to wear a turban. And by the way, that a kind of a lost art is musicians with turbans.
Yes.
Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs,
uh-huh.
Sonny Rhodes, Kim Wilson. I think 9/11 just kind of kiboshed that a little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, you can't do that. So, but yeah, just maybe not the most handsome dudes, but surround yourself with women in cars.
That's all
you get on MTV. Same thing with masked wrestlers.
Masked wrestlers, because Johnny Walker, God love him, rest his soul. He was not a handsome man, and he was not. And what's the thing is. Yeah, he was Mr. Wrestling number 2. Mr. Wrestling 1 was Tim Woods, who was a legit wrestler.
Yes.
He was a legit wrestler. He was coaching, I think, college wrestling at the same time he was winding down his professional career. He was a legit, he could legit hurt you in the ring. And Johnny Walker probably couldn't, just based on his physique. But man, I mean, Wrestling 2, it's hard to tell people and hard to explain this to people how Mr. Wrestling 2 was the biggest star maybe in the state of Georgia at the very least at the time.
President Carter's favorite.
He was President Carter's favorite. I did a whole piece. I get when Mr. Walker died, I get to do a whole piece on TV about
you did.
That. And he was, as he said, he could walk into a bank with his mask on and do business in the bank. And nobody said anything because he was wrestling too.
Right. Yes.
I mean, that's just what he did.
I'm going to tee you up. So wasn't he invited to the White House?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Here's the story. He was invited. Okay. It wasn't just Jimmy Carter who liked it. It was especially his mother, Miss Lillian Carter.
Yes.
She loved the wrestlers.
She would have been the old lady with the umbrella in the front row.
Oh, man. There is a great picture of her backstage at a Georgia Championship wrestling event with all these guys, you know, Bob Armstrong in his little teeny trunks back then. But he had his glasses on, of course.
Yeah, the big giant, yeah.
Big giant glasses. But, of course, he's standing there half naked, wrestling
hairy
too.
Dude.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But, I mean, the women loved Bob Armstrong back then, married as he was. Tommy Rich, who was? Charlie Cook was in that picture. It's just a host of big stars. And Ron West, who was a referee, he was kind of stuck in the back
right.
somewhere. But here she was. And she, during the 76 campaign, she gave an interview. I think the National Enquirer ran it, as I recall, about how she just loved their beautiful bodies. Doing the whole Miss Lillian Carter crazy old lady thing.
That's the fine line between that and you're the owner of a national football team.
Yeah.
And just, you know,
yeah.
one adjective away from going down a really bad path.
Uh-huh.
This is just an uncomfortable path with Lillian.
So there was a very famous picture taken during the campaign of Jimmy Carter with a very bad-looking side headlock on Wrestling 2.
Well, you know what? He hadn't been thrown to the dungeon of Stu Hart's basement. So
Carter won, and he invited Wrestling 2 to his inauguration. Wrestling 2 would not go unless he could wear the mask.
And the Secret
Service. Secret Service said, no, you can't do that.
I want a fringe show of Mr. Wrestling 2 and the Secret Service and their meeting. It's like 20 minutes.
Secret Service says, no, you can't do that. And Wrestling 2 says, well, no, I will politely decline your invitation.
See? Look at that. Integrity. Nice stuff there.
Yep.
That's good. Could you imagine that stuff? Well, and then I guess a former president got his head shaved.
Helped shave the head.
We're not going to talk about that.
No, man, that was a bad era of WWE.
That's a really bad era.
Yeah.
No, we're not going to go there. We're not going to go down that path of David Arquette winning the title. Just yeah, kind of harsh.
I'll take that over the head shaving of the other guy.
The other one.
Although, you know, to David Arquette's credit, David Arquette decided to go out and actually get trained.
He did, and almost bled to death.
Almost bled, yes. Almost sacrificed himself in the ring, basically. But I don't think he's wrestling much anymore. He's a certified Bob Ross painting instructor now.
Cool.
Because he actually appeared at Ball State at the big Bob Ross birthday
That's
celebration
right, he did.
Recently.
He did. Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
So I've always said this, that, and of course, there have been a number of wrestlers who have made the transition into acting. Dwayne mm-hmm. Johnson being setting the bar
by far. Yeah.
So I still wish that there had been a buddy cop film in 1978 of Dusty Rhodes and Ernie Ladd. So I mean, they made a series. They tried to do a pilot with Jesse Ventura and Roddy Piper as cops trying to get into wrestling. You do a Starsky and Hutch like thing with the American Dream and the Big Cat.
See, and you'd think they would be able to make that work because, well, one, well, you know, I don't know. I don't know how Dusty would be in a TV setting like that. Ernie Ladd was so underrated, I think, historically, as to just how incredible he was as a talent.
As well as teacher.
And a teacher. And, you know, he worked in Mid-South Wrestling really as the right-hand man of Cowboy Bill Watts. And let's be perfectly honest, Bill Watts, not exactly a progressive when it came to racial matters.
No, he was not.
But Ernie Ladd was a giant, a very large giant black man.
Yes, Dr. Freud.
And sorry about that.
So
and
Bill Watts' thing of, oh, I have a black friend.
Yeah, that was him. Because nobody was going to tell Ernie Ladd what to do because Ernie would have just whooped him right there. Legit. Because he was a massive human being, but he was so good on the mic, so believable.
Yep.
And he would have been a big star.
I think I have the vision of you'd have to have a Cadillac convertible.
Oh, no doubt.
So he could stand through. It's like do you remember the film Gator?
Yes.
Burt Reynolds' directorial debut.
Yes.
And Bones. Bones was the guy's name. It was him and Smiley, who was the dude in Blazing Saddles. Mm-hmm. He'd done another classic kind of Western, that guy.
Right.
But yeah, Bones had to drive with the roof open so he could act. And I see Ernie just doing a chase scene, driving while Dusty's out the window, you know, shooting the people, baby. You see, so somebody needs to make a 70s reboot of that. What could have been.
Yeah.
So
just find some giant, very
6'9", 330.
That was what they said he was. I don't know what he was legit, but he probably was close to that, because I know he played in the AFL.
That's right.
Ernie Ladd did before that.
And Wahoo McDaniel.
Wahoo McDaniel did as well.
And remember, when Wahoo did it, it was an Indian chop.
Yes.
But if you were Asian, it was a karate. It's this terrible, friends.
It is.
And if it was a rush, it was a sickle.
At least Wahoo McDaniel was an actual Native American.
That's true.
Unlike Strongbow.
Jay Strongbow.
Yes.
but you know, James Caan, everyone's favorite Italian actor who was really Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
Friends, again, we're just reporting this. This is just what happened.
Yep.
So,
indeed.
All right. So, what do you think you're going to share with your family next cinematically?
Ooh. Gosh, I don't know.
You know, it also seems like with the news, I mean, you've been really good about moments in pop culture. Mm-hmm. I know earlier this week you did the He's So Fine, My Sweet Lord court case.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yes.
So just wasn't sure if there was anything that goes along those ways as far as stuff that pops up in the news. I know we've been doing the 50th anniversary of hip-hop. So.
Oh, yeah, that's been so fun to hear, especially to hear Terry Gross do it on Fresh Air, which is just, it's hilarious.
We never thought we'd be covering this much hip-hop on this format.
You know. It's just so, I keep waiting for her to start dropping bars, you know, from, and if you don't know, now you know.
That's really interesting.
Join us.
I doubt that.
You never know. She did a promo with Donna Summer's "Love to Love You, Baby" not long ago.
You did acknowledge that, yeah. There,
which was hilarious.
How do we put it? There are sounds in that song,
right,
that well, one would like to have seen the recording session.
Oh, we kind of, if you've seen the Donna Summer documentary on HBO Max, I don't know if there's film of the recording session on there, but yeah, there's lots of good film on there. We'll just say that.
Have you heard of the percussion used at the end of Aerosmith's Ragdoll?
Yeah.
Oh, you've heard? Okay.
Yeah.
There's no footage of that either.
No.
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 So we're just going to leave that. We're going to leave that out there. So, Ray, I really, really appreciate you coming in.
Hey, no problem, man.
And you can listen to Ray on Morning Edition. So, 5 to 10.
5 to 9. Well, 5 to 9, 5 to 9 for Morning Edition, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so when in doubt, if you give a falsehood to Ray, like Gordon Solie, he'll go, well, I don't think that's necessarily true, Mr. Ladd. There's footage here that would show you this.
Well,
so.
You got to say that.
The other thing, it got to a point with Lance Russell that he wouldn't even tell you what was going on. But like,
right.
Lawler. He's about ready to hit somebody with a chair. And you just, because you see him hitting with a chair, you're like, Lawler, in case you don't know who's doing it. So
right, right.
We'll work on that for television,
okay.
For radio. So
sure will.
Thanks, Ray.
Thank you, man.
That's Ray Steele. You can hear him on Morning Edition here at WFYI during the week in the mornings. Thank you. Thanks, Ray. Happy birthday. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. All right, let's go around the horn. Over at the Tibbs Drive-In this weekend, on screen one, Barbie, Blue Beetle, and then Meg 2. Wow, that's a weekend. Screen two, Poultrygeist, Slaughterhouse, and Zombievers. On screen three, Equalizer 3, then Talk to Me. And then they show Equalizer 3 again. Screen four, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Gran Turismo, and Strays. All of that is happening at the Tibbs Drive-In over at the Skyline this weekend. Your double feature, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Barbie. And, so that's happening over at the Skyline Drive-In. Over at IU Cinema, Friday, 7 o'clock, September 1st, Pop star Never Stop Never Stopping. Really, it's kind of the Spinal Tap of boy bands. So check that out. Underrated film. Tuesday, September 5th at 7 o'clock, Love in the Time of Federal. Thursday, September 7th, 7 p.m., Liquid Handcuffs, a documentary to free methadone. Friday, September 8th at 7 p.m., Fantasia from 1940. Saturday, September 9th at 4 p.m. is a part of the Saturday Matinee Classics from 1932, Betty Davis, Joan Blondell, and Dvorak, Three on a Match. Sunday, September 10th at 1 o'clock is the Cat Video Fest 2023, 1 o'clock, Saturday, September 10th. Wednesday, September 13th, films for 1 to 8 projectors, that's happening at 7 o'clock. Tuesday, September 19th at 7 p.m. is the Truman Show. All of that is happening over at IU Cinema. Over at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin, I guess they have the weekend off, but Wednesday, September 6th at 7:30 p.m. as a part of the midweek music series, Selena. Wednesday, September 13th at 7:30 p.m., also from the midweek music series, The Last Waltz. Friday and Saturday, September 15th and 16th, 2 and 7:30 p.m., Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, Part 1. All of that is happening over at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. As I mentioned, Golden Globus Theater this week is Robo War with Reb Brown. So if you love your blonde guy, beefy guy screaming, go check out Robo War and Golden Globus Theater. All right, friends, let's grab a pencil and let's find out what you've been watching this week. We'll see how the algorithms on social media are working this week. They were short last week. We start on Twitter with Christina. It was great to see Christina over at Big Lug. Go run over there if you get a chance. Hector and the Search for Happiness is happening over there. And that's it over on X. So thank you, gang, over there. Like that. On Facebook, Doug writes a couple early Warner Brother flicks, Blonde Crazy with a You Dirty Rat era James Cagney, and Three on a Match, which, wow, with early supporting roles from Betty Davis and Humphrey Bogart. In an unusual noir from Jean Renoir, The Woman on the Beach from 1947. Daniel writes Raiders of the Lost Ark, Passages, How to Marry a Millionaire, The Fugitive Kind, Victor Victoria, and The Fury. Thank you, Daniel. Okay, Gary writes Attack of the Crab Monsters, Poco Rosso, The Amazing Mr. No Legs, The Original Shaft, Freaks, Murder Rock, Mud Honey, a.k.a. Tommy Chong. That's a title. That's not Mud Honey. And Tommy is, his nickname is not Mud Honey. The Greatest Showman and Baba Yaga. Thank you, Doug, for chiming in again. I know I told you to. Netflix documentary series, The Andy Warhol Diaries, and four Alan Ladd noirs. Glass Key, This Gun for Hire, The Blue Dahlia, and Chicago Deadline. I saw the latter at the Chicago's Grand Music Box Theater as a part of their Noir City Festival. Great to see it in a packed house filled with noir fans. That's great to hear, Doug. I love the Music Box. It's one of my favorite places on the planet, and I love taking my family there whenever possible. Brian writes, first-time viewings, Dog Day Afternoon, Krampus, The Original Invisible Man, 30 Days of Night, and Thief. Really strong list there, Brian. David writes Night of the Hunter. Eric writes Imitation of Life, the Colbert version. Eric, first views, Bombshell, the Hedy Lamarr story, Love Me or Leave Me, Pearl, and Hal Ashby's directing debut, The Landlord. There's a Hal Ashby documentary I need to revisit. I'm glad you reminded me of that, Eric. His rewatches, The Departed, The Magnificent Seven, Catch 22 in honor of the great Alan Arkin, and Wild in the Country in observance for Tuesday Weld's birthday. That's always a good reason to celebrate. And Eric, I you bring that up. One of the first songs I heard Los Straitjackets do when I got to the radio, when I got to radio the other, last night, they did the theme from The Magnificent Seven. It was very exciting. Doug asks, I recently rewatched Love Me or Leave Me. What was your take? Eric, I thought it was terrific until the last 15 minutes when they decided to do an about face and fabricate some sort of redemption for Marty. Send the audience out feeling good. Mostly I didn't believe Ruth's actions at the end, but the rest was marvelous. almost ahead of its time. Excellent performances by both James Cagney and Doris Day. Doug agreeing, among musical biopics, it's one of the best and almost assuredly the reason Ruth Etting is remembered today to whatever degree she is. Thank you, guys. Amanda went to the library. Insomnia, Love Story, because love means never having to say you're sorry. Blue Velvet, The Dark Tower, and Oppenheimer at the IMAX, as well as Pritzi's Honor. Thank you. Jolene writes, we finally watched Cocaine Bear, The Clone Tyrone, and Zombieland Double Tap. Hilarity ensued. Jolene, I know you. You watched all three in one day, right? That's one evening. That's very strong. That's a lot of pizza and beer. So wish I was there. Daniel writes, The Front Runner, The Forgiven, Love and Death, and The Shadow. Amanda has an... Oh, she went back to the library for more rentals. Goodwill Hunting and Wild. She also sent me these direct messages. She wasn't sure if they went through. They went through. Missy writes, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle, Mutant Mayhem. I was pleasantly surprised, as well as The Whale. Jamie writes, Scary Movie 5. Bill writes, Barbie and the Man Who Came to Dinner, which would be a fun show if they were combined. Kristen writes, Day Shift with Jamie Foxx. Your basic vampire comedy. Thank you. Adam writes, Oppenheimer. Brian writes, Reb Brown's TV's first Captain America, yes. And also went to see Blue Beetle. I enjoyed it. I posted a montage of Reb Brown's greatest hits. Nancy writes, Asteroid City and the Venture Brothers. Radiant is the blood of the baboon heart. Devin writes, Chippendale Rescue Rangers. Patty writes, The Pagemaster, The Baron of Arizona, Twice Told Tales, and His Kind of Woman. Melissa writes, About Fate and Stand By Me. David writes, 65. And finally, Catherine writes, Oppenheimer for the third time. That's 9 hours right there. And there you go, friends. That's what you've been watching this week. So hopefully you got to see some good movies that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. Friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's a few out there. Thanks for listening, and we'll do this again next week. And once again, happy birthday, Ray Steele. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!